The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So my name is Patrice Kelch, and I am a longtime member of Common Ground and a student of the Dharma, and really happy to be here with you all this evening. So I ask people sort of what they do when they're not practicing, or so what I do when I'm not involved with Common Ground is I sit with people who are incarcerated at Stillwater Correctional Facility, and I've been doing that for a little more than 2 decades. Try to do that at least once a month. And there are some other volunteers who go. Although it just might interest you to know that one of the issues at a lot of the correctional facilities right now is simply that they're really hard to staff. So their numbers are really low. So it's often the case that programs get canceled and there's a lockdown or something just because there's not enough staff. And that's really hard. Now, if you're counting on people coming and sitting with you to not be able to do that. And it's hard for the staff is doing the best they can, but that's just something I kind of keep in my heart, because there have been a couple of times where a couple of months in a row, I've been scheduled to go out and I get a notice that there's just not enough staff. So they're going to have to put people on lockdown. So, and I'm also on the board of the Minnesota Multi-Faith Network, which is a really interesting organization that believes that people should be talking to and with each other across, learning about each other's practices, learning, I think, mostly about each other's goodness, which has been really interesting. And I'm also pretty active with Isaiah and Faith in Minnesota, which is an organization that works to make legislative changes for a truly multiracial democracy and a caring economy and a just climate future. So, and I personally find that there's Dharma work in all of that. So tonight my topic is relational Dharma as a path of practice. And I know that among my cohort, often, we say, well, how's your practice going? And usually the response is something like, well, I try to sit every morning for at least 45 minutes, and I listen to Dharma talks when I can, and show up at Common Ground, or, that we tend to talk about our practice as our formal, our formal mindfulness practice or our formal sitting practice. And we don't usually talk about our practice as relational practice nearly as much. And for those of you who've heard me talk before, what I almost always talk about is how the most important thing about us as a species is our tremendous capacity for care. And we're not the only species who cares. I mean, especially among the primates, we see a lot of care, a lot of pro-social behavior. But what we notice about human beings is that human beings can not only care for other human beings outside of their own kin structure, care about people they don't know at all, people who are really different, care a lot about other species. And I remember years ago when I was at, I was sort of coordinating a chaplaincy program for United Theological. And one of the students who was actually a Quaker, she said, the one thing I really love about the Buddhist is they really take into account the possibility of alien life. They have, wishing well for all beings, all possible beings. And I just thought that was pretty charming. So we do have this, tremendous capacity for care. And none of us would be here today if other human beings hadn't cared enough about us to keep us alive. You know, I mean, this is sort of the great thing about being a human being, is we just have this tremendous capacity to care about not only sort of animals, but nature. I mean, we just it's just this remarkable ability that the heart can really open to all these kinds of things. And you know, if we look at the Eightfold Path, we'll see how many of those practices are really focused on relations. And as I was preparing this, I thought this is going to be like sort of speed dating the top hits in Buddhism. But so we're going to go over a lot of sort of familiar, what may be familiar material, maybe not for everyone. But as I started to think about it, there's just so much in the teachings that is all about how we relate skillfully to each other. So in the Eightfold Path, which is the, you know, the path that when we talk about the Buddhist analysis of how things are, that we all experience suffering in some way. And it's, the word is dukkha. And etymologically, it comes from like the hub of a wheel being out of alignment with the axle. So it's dukkha is really being out of alignment. So it's most often translated as suffering, but it's stress, distress, unease. And if you go back to that etymological root, that session, that idea that we're just somehow out of alignment with how things have come to be. And so the Buddha's analysis is that we recognize that there's suffering, there's dukkha, distress in our lives. There's a cause for it. And the cause is our clinging, clinging to what we want, or clinging to wishing that things were sort of different than they were. It's that sort of pushing away, not being satisfied with, we don't have what we want. Sometimes people say it's, you know, we don't have what we want, we get what we don't want. It's that whole idea of this kind of the, in the Pali, it's like a thirst that can never be satisfied. Although some contemporary practitioners, foremost among them, Stephen Batchelor, talks about dukkha actually as our reactivity, that's the cause of our suffering, that to understand it in a more contemporary psychological framework, that our suffering is often about our reactivity to how things are, the circumstances we find ourselves in. So we have suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's the possibility of cessation. And the way we do that is to follow the Eightfold Path. So you know, the Buddha gives us a kind of map of how we can develop ourselves to end our suffering. And the first part is about sort of wise or skillful view, which is understanding the four causes. It's recognizing cause and effect, that things just don't happen spontaneously, that there's always a cause, sometimes multiple causes, constellation of causes, but that the world is in some sense a very lawful world. There are causes. So a lot of our practice is trying, when something happens, to go back and understand what the causes were, so that we can avoid the effect again. So we have this skillful understanding of cause and effect, which also is actually karma. Karma is looking at sort of our intentional actions and what are their consequences. Just so that's what, when we begin with this sort of wise view, this skillful view, skillful understanding. And the word vipassana, which sometimes we talk about our vipassana practice, we often say, you know, that's how things are, seeing how things are. But actually, the really literal translation of that and the better translation is seeing how things have come to be, understanding how things have come to be. So it has this sort of, it's not just, oh, this is how things, but understanding everything that has come to be has come to be out of causes. The second part of the Eightfold Path is wise or skillful intention. And that's, could be either understood as renunciation, giving up things, or generosity. And it's, goodwill, loving kindness, and it is non-harming. And that's all pretty relational. So the idea of generosity, of goodwill or loving kindness, metta, and this intention not to harm, again, very, very relational. When we talk about skillful speech, it is speech that is timely, truthful, helpful, and offered in a spirit of loving kindness or a spirit of non-harming. Again, that this is one of the aspects of the path is going to be how we relate to each other through speech. Skillful action. And this is often characterized as the precepts, but it's refraining from killing or from harming, refraining from taking what's not freely given to us, refraining from sexual misconduct or sexual harm, refraining again from false or harmful speech, and refraining from ingesting anything that would cause us to be careless. Sometimes that's just refraining from intoxicants, but if we think about it as refraining from ingesting anything, whether it's movies, it's not just sort of alcohol or pharmaceuticals. It's refraining from taking in anything that is going to make us, and again, in Stephen Batchelor, sometimes this is translated as heedless, but Stephen Batchelor translates it as careless in both senses of the word, in being heedless, not caring how things happen, but also being heartless. So carelessness can be understood both as being heedless and being heartless. So again, this is all about how we relate to each other. Skillful livelihood is the fifth of the eight precepts. And in the Buddhist time, the way the Buddha talked about this was dealing in weapons, poisons, or in living beings, both animal and human. So not engaging in the slaughter of animals, not engaging in slavery, not engaging in prostitution, or dishonest practices. He talked about how important it was for people who are merchants to be fair and to be engaged in really ethical practices. And today people talk about, being involved as best they can in occupations that are not harmful to others, not harmful to the earth, not harmful to other persons. And, it's a practice. When we talk about, the Eightfold Path, you just step back for a moment. It's like the first two about wise understanding and wise intention. That's kind of the wisdom part. This middle part of wise speech, wise livelihood, and wise action are called sila, morality, the ethical part. And it's only the last three parts of the Eightfold Path that are specifically about a meditation practice, and that's for skillful and wise effort, and that's about not as best you can, not bringing about unwholesome thoughts. If you've got unwholesome thoughts, doing the best you can to eliminate them, to sustaining, bringing about wholesome thoughts, and cultivating them, sustaining wholesome thoughts. And You can think about this as very much like our metta practice. You know, how often in metta practice, our intention is to abandon ill will as best we can and to cultivate this kind of wholesome concern for our own welfare and the welfare of others. And then there is skillful mindfulness, four foundations of mindfulness, body, feeling, mind states, phenomena. And then skillful samadhi, which is, again, most often translated as concentration, but it's sort of the collectedness of the mind, the having the mind be very, very collected, not scattered at all. So if we think about relational dharma in terms of the Eightfold Path, you know, it seems that, you know, the majority of the path is really focused on how we relate to each other in this world. And there's a very famous passage where Ananda, who was the Buddha's younger cousin and his attendant, said to the Buddha, he said, you know, Venerable Lord, it seems to me that having good companions, good friends, noble companions, that is half the holy life. And the Buddha said, oh no, Ananda, don't say that, Ananda. That is not correct, Ananda. Good friends, skillful, I'm trying to remember exactly how it said, it's, good friends, noble companions, that is the whole of the holy life. And what's so interesting to me is that we often think about, the life of the Buddha and the monks, but so much of what the Buddha taught with his community was really about how to get along together. There's a story in one of the suttas where the Buddha and Ananda come across a monk who was really sick. And he was in his own little hut. He had dysentery. He was lying in his own excrement. No one had taken care of him. And the Buddha and Ananda clean up this poor monk and take care of him. And then the Buddha calls the whole assembly. And he says, why did no one take care of this monk? And one of the monks said, he was not useful to us. And the Buddha really chastises them. He said, you have come here to live together. You no longer live with your mother and father, your family of origin. This is your family. You need to take care of each other. You need to live with this kind of regard for each other. And it was, this idea that they were like a family, that and if you ever go online and look at the Vinaya, which is the list of rules that monks have to observe, and there are more than 200 of them, and there are even more for nuns. So many of them are about personal hygiene. I mean, they're just what kind of medicine you can have. They're just so nitpicky. In some ways, but it was because in the Buddhist community, people from different castes came together from different life experiences came together, and the Buddha wanted to make sure that they could live in harmony. So there are all these rules about, well, this is the way we're going to do it. And often in the Vinaya, there's a story about why it is that this rule came to be, because monks were arguing over what was the right way to do it. So everybody actually is supposed to like urinate the same way. And I believe it's urinating, like not standing up completely, but I'm not, don't quote me on that. But I think that, I mean, there are just all these sort of personal things when you have a lot of people living together. How do you live in a way that minimizes friction? And so it's just interesting to think that a lot of what the Buddha was involved in sort of administratively was like sorting out relationships. How can we get all these people from very different backgrounds, some who have a lot of experience in practice, some who don't. People were, you know, becoming ordained. Sometimes people were leaving. And in the nuns community, it was often that the nuns community was a refuge for widowed women, for abandoned women, for women who were disgraced in some ways. And a lot of the women who came there with a very strong spiritual interest. But a lot of women came because it was a safe place for them to be. And it was all about taking care of each other. And sometimes when we read the poems that the nuns wrote, they're all so beautiful about regarding each other as sister or as grandmother or as friend, and how much they helped each other. So even in the sort of monastic communities of the Buddhist time, so much of it was about how do we relate to each other skillfully. And one of the things that I found slightly amusing, you know, this image of our statue of the Buddha here, this is the no fear mudra. But many, 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 many years ago, when I was in Thailand, there was a display of like the seven, like a Buddha for every day of the week with a different gesture. And the only one I remember out of all seven was this one. The Buddha's like this. And it is dispelling the family quarrels. So, you know, if you might want to have one of those little images in your house, dispelling the family quarrels. Another arena in which the Buddha left instructions about how to get along relationally was in cultivation of the paramis. And paramis are, sometimes they're translated, excuse me, as qualities of perfection. But actually, the paramis are what we might think of as virtues. But they're the things to cultivate to live in harmony. And there are 10 of them. And they're, it's generosity or morality, which is sometimes translated as integrity, how to live a life with ethical integrity, renunciation, wisdom, virya, energy, which also gets translated as courage, patience, truthfulness, determination or perseverance, loving kindness, and equanimity. And you know, these are all expressions when we are engaging with each other, as well as some of them might be like engaging with our practice, like perseverance and patience. But often these are exactly the qualities that we find ourselves in need of in our relationships with other persons. And even, I would say sometimes our relationship with our pets. We need a considerable amount of patience and loving kindness, perseverance. So all of these in the teachings are all about how we learn to live in harmony with each other. And I think about often the Brahmavihara practices, and the Brahmaviharas, the translation of that is they're the divine abodes, the great places that we can let our minds rest. So if you think about it as like sort of peaceful dwelling places for the mind would be one way to think about the Brahmaviharas. And the Buddha said, one of the Brahmaviharas is always accessible to us. And the first is loving kindness, which is when we abandon ill will and we just have this sort of warmth, concern for ourselves. No, may we be free from harm. May we live in ease. May we have strength. And I always include May we accept ourselves completely, just as we are right now, with great kindness. So we have this loving kindness practice that we do for ourselves, but also for others. And when we do the practice, we do it for people we care about and people that are strangers to us that we don't know at all. And even eventually we do this practice for the persons who are the challenging persons in our lives. Compassion practice and compassion, self-compassion practice or compassion practice is when we we see suffering, we understand suffering, and we have a response that is a response wishing for that suffering to be alleviated. When I love this little factoid that when the monks who, Tibetan monks who have practiced compassion for, you know, decades, were examined by the people at in Madison, the people who are studying sort of the physiology of compassion. What they noticed was that when these monks are in a state of compassion, that they have more oxytocin in their bloodstream, you know, the hormone that's all about connecting. And they also have a little shot of dopamine, which is sort of the primer to act. So it's, you know, compassion physiologically makes us connect and primes us to act. We have the mudita practice or the sympathetic joy practice when we can be glad for the happiness of another being. Again, that's a beautiful relational practice. And when we have joy for our own good fortune, the response often is, and may this good fortune, this good thing that's happened to me, may my happiness be a benefit to all beings everywhere. That we have this wanting to let whatever goodness we experience be shared with others. And finally, we have the equanimity practice, which is sort of the big picture practice. It's the practice that recognizes impermanence. It's the practice that is able to keep things in perspective, to have some balance, to understand that that events are impersonal in a way, that events are the result of causes. And we see a kind of impersonality in that. And we recognize our own limitations too when we do an equanimity practice. So these are all deeply rooted in our day-to-day, can be deeply rooted in our day-to-day interactions. And that we can really turn our antennae to seeing these as forms of practice throughout the day. Sometimes, particularly in a place like Thailand, it may be that someone will choose to work on one of these paramis for a year. They'll just decide, okay, this is what I'm going to work on this year. It's going to be patience. It's going to be generosity. And that's a wonderful kind of resolution to have, just to say, okay, this is what I'm going to pay attention to this this year. Or, you know, we might decide that we really want to really focus on a practice of self-compassion, that's what's really needed in this moment. Or a practice of sympathetic joy, appreciative joy. So, you know, these are all wonderful, wonderful practices that we can incorporate into our lives. That, and I find in all these cases that our mindfulness practice really supports all of these, that there is such a wonderful dovetailing because we've learned how to pay attention. And that we pay attention, we are so much we can see our own actions, our own intentions more clearly when we pay attention. And Sharon Salzberg has a wonderful saying that seems to me really true, that attention is the doorway to compassion. Attention is the doorway to compassion. And when we really look at sort of what's going on in the world and see it in its complexity and see the complexity of the causes of all the sorts of things that lead to extremely troubling, distressing circumstances, that we really can have more compassion when we really pay attention to it. And I would say that that's something too that I think I have learned from practicing with people who are incarcerated, who in many ways are very wise, very have become very very good at understanding themselves, and often very dedicated to practice. But it's seeing that and seeing sort of some of the difficult circumstances that they've come from is really a great generator of compassion. Ruth King, who is a wonderful, wonderful teacher and has been here, she was here probably now 5 or 6 years ago at Common Ground, wrote a wonderful book called Mindful of Race that is well worth your time to read. Ruth often begins when there's a group gathered together. She has people say, "I am here because you are here. You are here because I am here. Our hearts are old friends." And sometimes she will encourage people, like in this, and she did it in this very Dharma hall, get up and walk around and just kind of hold your heart. And to every person you meet, that our hearts are old friends. And to really believe that, again, with this capacity to care, that my caring heart is an old friend of your caring heart. So it is a beautiful practice. Sharing the merit is another wonderful relational practice. I think it's where we get to practice just enormous imaginative generosity, that we just send our good wishes out. If there's any benefit to what I'm doing, may all these different people share in it. May the planet share in it. May our animals share in it. Valerie Carr, the wonderful Sikh activist, often says that one of the principles of the Sikh religion is see no stranger. That's one of their core teachings, is see no stranger. It's just someone you don't know yet. There are no strangers. See no strangers. So I thought I would finish this tonight with a reading from a sutta, and it's the Maha Mangala Sutta, the sutta about what are the blessings that we have. And what I'd like you to look for as I read them, because it's a varied list, how many of them are about our relational lives, about how we are with each other. So the Buddha was asked, what are the highest blessings? And the Buddha says, not to associate with the foolish, but to associate with the wise, and to honor those worthy of honor. This is the highest blessing. To reside in a suitable locality, to have performed meritorious actions in the past, and to set oneself in the right direction. This is the highest blessing. Vast learning, skill in handicrafts, well-grounded in discipline and pleasant speech, this is the highest blessing. To support one's father and mother, to cherish one's partner and children, and to be engaged in peaceful occupations, this is the highest blessing. Tolerance, righteous conduct, rendering assistance to relatives, and performance of blameless deeds, this is the highest blessing. To cease and abstain from evil, to abstain from intoxicating drinks, and diligent in performing righteous acts, this is the highest blessing. Reverence, humility, contentment, gratitude, and the timely hearing of the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha, this is the highest blessing. Patience, obedience, meeting wise teachers, and timely discussions on the Dhamma, this is the highest blessing. Self-control, chastity, comprehension of the noble truths, and the realization of Nibbana, this is the highest blessing. The mind that is not touched by the vicissitudes of life, or sometimes we call them the worldly winds, the mind that is free from sorrow, stainless and secure, this is the highest blessings. Those who have fulfilled the conditions for such blessings are victorious everywhere and attain happiness everywhere. To them are the highest blessings. So there's this whole list of all things. This is the highest blessing, and this is the highest blessing. Look at all these amazing blessings in our lives. The one that sort of surprised me was vast learning, skill in handicrafts, well-grounded in discipline, and pleasant speech, all about how we live our lives, do what we can do to support our parents, to cherish our partner, our children, to be engaged in peaceful occupations. These are the highest blessings. And then to, you know, be able to engage in righteous conduct, rendering assistance to relatives, performance of blameless deeds, reverence, humility, contentment, gratitude, timely hearing of the Dhamma. I mean, this is our this is our life, right? This is what we can aspire to. And the Buddha says this is a blessed life. So so it seemed to me, especially as we have a holiday that coming up that is, even with its very complicated origins, it's a day where we can think about gratitude and think about what the blessings of our lives are and how the Dharma is and can be, you know, infused in our everyday life, that our practice really is living in harmony with each other, living in harmony with the planet, being the person who makes other people's days better, being the good listener, being the person who shows up, being the person who doesn't abandon. This is the Dharma of relationships. It's how we are with others. And as the Buddha says, this is the holy life. Our association with others is really the holy life. And that we do what we can to support each other. So when we come together like this on Zoom and here in person, what we're really doing is we're offering support to each other, and we're getting support from each other. And this is what Sangha is. You know, one of the three, they talk about, we all talk about the triple jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And the Sangha, the community that comes together, this is the great blessing. And how we do our best to live in honesty and in harmony with each other is really, it is a blessing that we have this precious human life, this incredibly precious human life, where we get to just care immensely. We are so fortunate. And And so with that, I thank you all for your very kind attention and would be happy to hear your reflections. If you have any questions, that's fine. But if you have any reflections on living the Dharma or the blessings that we have, it would be lovely to share it with others. And I've got a mic here. And if you're on Zoom, we can try to do that that too. So who would like to share something?
Yeah. Hi, my name's Kevin here in Minneapolis. I was just listening, and this last summer I spent, at least a couple of months doing road trips through the West, the Western states, partly, the red states, the Trump supporters, and just to go and kind of watch, kind of see what I could see. And, when I headed out this summer, I expected to run into, kind of the stereotypes, that we get here in the city, of gun-toting, all those stereotypes. I don't need to go into them. And I was surprised that I never ran into that once. That, when you go out through the West and see how people live their lives, there was nothing hateful. They had, valued community and friendships, and they were trying to make a living and take care of their family. And but just listening, I thought about was, when you go on in community, it's kind of like you run into what you bring with you a lot. And studying the Dharma, if you study, compassion and gratitude and generosity, that's all you can really see in other people. And the only thing that was upsetting is like when you turn on to the AM radio, which is all they have, a lot of it's community radio, what's going on in the schools and crop reports and that. But like the national AM radio is just very hateful. I could only listen to it a few minutes at a time before I had to turn it off. And that's what these people are listening to, or at least some of them. So, of course, if they're just hearing these, racist and misogynist and that kind of talk, of course it's going to make it into their life. But I never really ran into that. So.
I'll give it to Anne in a minute, but what that reminds me of is there's a sort of this story about there's a woman, in ancient times, a woman sat outside the city gate and she had water, and travelers who were coming and come to the city would stop by her little tent and get some water and take a breath before they entered the gates of the city. And that traveler came and said to her, what are the people like in this city? And she says to him, the traveler, she says, well, what are the people like where you come from? And he said, they're wonderful people. They're just kind and generous and, they're just so good. And she said, well, you will find that here. And then, another person comes and you can immediately see where this is going. What are the people like where you come from? Oh, they're terrible. They're awful. They lie. They cheat. They're miserable. She said, well, you'll find that here. So it's, you know, what you were saying, Kevin, sort of sometimes what we bring as our prejudice or our expectation really affects what we actually see. So, Anne, you wanted to say something?
Sometimes this is called a wisdom and compassion practice. And I don't, why is compassion not one of the Brahma Viharis?
Well, compassion is one of the Brahma Viharas. It's not one of the Paramis. And I have asked this question myself. And I was told one of the responses is, well, compassion is a form of loving kindness. It's one of the flavors of metta. So that if we understand metta, as the abandoning of ill will, this is one of the flavors of it. And Venerable Analio has this wonderful visual for it. Analio says that metta is like the sun at noon, shining on everything. Compassion is like the sun at dusk, and it's sort of a little melancholy. It's sympathetic joy is like the sun in the morning, the rising sun, which seems to be so energizing. And equanimity is like the light of the full moon. And it's a kind of cooler, different light that allows us to see things a little differently. But the other answer I did get about compassion, and I actually asked this to Gil Fronsdal years ago, and he said, well, not every Buddha has compassion. And I was just shocked. And there's a kind of Buddha called a Pacheka Buddha. And that is someone who goes off and through his or her or their own practice study realizes liberation, completely lets go of greed, hatred, delusion, obsession with self, is completely self-liberated, but doesn't teach, doesn't share. And the Buddha, people always talk about the Buddha teaching out of compassion. Because when the Buddha first awakened, the Buddha said to himself, this will be tiresome. Not very many people are going to get this. I don't think, given his years of asceticism before that and all of his experience, I don't think other people are going to get this. So his initial impulse was not to teach. And the story is that a heavenly being came down and said to him, there are people with only a little dust in their eyes who would be so grateful for this. And then the Buddha decided to teach. So, I mean, that's kind of the story, sort of mythic story about that. But what we can take from that is this idea that teaching is an act of compassion. So that's just sort of going in two different directions. And I was really shocked when someone said, you don't need compassion to be liberated in the sense of letting go of the fetters. So that would be like being liberated without any relational dharma at all, just being kind of a hermit who self-liberates. But that's another response to that. Mm-hmm. T. Yeah.
So I would respond to what you, Kevin, was talking about, because so in response to what you were mentioning about your experience with people from the other side of the political aisle, like I personally from the deep south, so I have like a lot of experience with being with the population, because and it really goes back to how I think like it's the lack of compassion and self-compassion and compassion that that's what I'm seeing from the people as a whole. And a lot of times I understand where they're coming from, why they don't have compassion, because they're not taught that way, because they're taught, to have us versus them mentality. They're taught to be like, oh, okay, well, you don't believe X, Y, or Z, then you must be a racist, or you must be that. It's actually, and I'm like, well, I'm an Asian in the Deep South where I don't see it. Like, a lot of times I don't even see that's the case neither. And it's just a lot of times it's what the media actually says one thing. And I'm like, wait, is that really what is happening? I mean, yes, there might be some extreme cases, but in general, people down there do not behave the way that the media would like us to believe. But anyway, what I'm saying is that I think it goes back to compassion and understanding experience. But I have my own question. My question is when you mention about the highest order, highest blessing, like, I guess it's, and when you mention like some of the specific activities that one would, or things that one would do, I don't know, like, maybe I just can't quite comprehend, but is it more of perfectionism per se, or am I misinterpreting it?
That is a really good question. This idea about the highest blessings, is this perfectionism? And what we know is that perfectionism is really toxic. That we know that perfectionism is about never being good enough, never, you know, there's no way to be perfect. As I mentioned, Ruth said, you know, life is imperfect, impermanent, and impersonal. So when we hear this sort of the highest blessings, I see this as much more of a sort of poetic rendering, that it's sort of a rhetorical structure. In here, these are the highest blessings. You know, perfectionism is one of the things that people talk about, particularly as a feature of white dominant culture. This idea about perfection is you have to be perfect. It's never ever good enough, and this is supposed to be kind of what keeps us motivated to do better, but actually what it does is it shames and undermines us instead of being able to relate to our own human fallibility. And that's what we are all fallible in that way. So in talking about compassion, it seems to me that perfectionism is kind of one of the enemies of compassion. But that's a great question. And if we interpret the Buddha's teaching as telling us that we have to strive to be perfect, that really is sort of a cultural overlay, I think, of the Buddha telling us, you know, to try to do our best. That these sorts of translations, I looked actually at three different translations of the of this sutta, and they're all pretty stiff, and some of them render it in more of a like poetic verses. So but it's really just wonderfully expressing that there are lots of blessings in our life. Oh, this is the highest blessing. Well, this is also the highest blessing, and this one is the highest blessing. So it's about not ranking them like walking up going up a ladder. It's like all of these things are really extraordinary blessings in our lives. And it is, I think, in any practice, especially here in the West with the dominant culture that we have, it is very, very easy to sort of slip into what is clearly an unhealthy perfectionism. This is really about I believe, living in harmony, living with great care, living with great tenderness, great love. And perfectionism is kind of incompatible with love in any of its forms. So we're just about out of time. And I really appreciate your being here. So let's do the sharing of the merit, and then Ryan's going to say something. So again, this beautiful act of imaginative generosity of relational dharma. If there's any goodness to our practice, any benefit or blessing or merit, we would gladly, happily, joyfully share it with others. In fact, if we could, we would give it all away, every bit of it. We would share any blessings with our teachers, our parents, our families, our friends. We would share any goodness with our community. We'd share the merit with the people we like and also the people we don't like so much. We would share any blessings with the people we know and the millions upon millions of people that we have yet to know. And in addition to all the two-leggeds, we would share any blessings, any goodness with the four-leggeds, the many-leggeds, the winged, the scaly, the slimy, and the finny. May all beings find a path to peace. May all beings be free from suffering.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.